You know, we just missed the 13th annual Whiskey Rebellion Festival. I tell you true, down in the little town of Berlin in the Laurel Highlands, took place 2 weeks ago. Now, I'm not sure what they do there. I'm not sure whether they tar and feather local officials or refuse to pay taxes for a week, or even if they sample their local legal and illegal spirits, but it does sound, doesn't it, like your better-than-average local festival? Now, speaking of the Whiskey Rebellion, we might look at it as the last violent gasp of a 30 years war that began with the Stamp Act Rebellion of 1765. Now, just as that colony-wide rebellion shocked the British into more and more repressive attempts to centralize the empire, so Shays' Rebellion of 1786, as Forrest MacDonald says, gave powerful stimulus toward the convening of the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Now, the Whiskey Rebellion, mostly taking place in 1794, was put down rather easily and rather ruthlessly by President Washington, but it also had a certain centralizing effect by rounding out Hamilton's program to establish internal taxes. Once Hamilton got his national bank and his internal taxes, as they say, all the rest was history. Now, this isn't by any means the whole story of American independence, but it is a fairly important slice. Tax rebellions were important, and even a quick reading of the documents shows that both the Shaysites and the Whiskey Rebels thought that they were doing the same thing in 1786 and 1794 that they had been asked to do in 1776. Furthermore, the tax problems between the empire and the colonies as a whole tended to transfer into the colonies as a major part of their own east-west tensions. During this 30-year tax war, ethnic factors also played an important part, and nowhere more explicitly than in Pennsylvania, where much of the frontier was populated by wild Scotsmen and other Celtic peoples, the so-called Scots-Irish, who dominated almost the entire Appalachian Highlands by the 1760s. And although the great Republican documents were usually written in Philadelphia or New York or Boston, it was often around Pittsburgh that their ambiguities began to pop out like political sores. Now, the term nation building wouldn't have meant much to our ancestors, but we could argue that nation building began at the confluence of the Allegheny and the Monongahela rivers. It's also nicely symbolic for our purposes that the former river, the Allegheny, flows in from a part of New York that was in the 1790s rapidly being settled by New Englanders who were displacing the great people of the Longhouse, the Iroquois. And the latter, the Monongahela, flows in from Virginia, which had long had claims and designs on the whole valley of La Belle Riviere. George Washington, in fact, had a personal stake in a strong national settlement of the Whiskey Rebellion. It would increase the value of his western lands considerably, and it did. Now, the picture is even bigger, however. Just as Pittsburgh in the early 1760s stood at a critical strategic point between the French and British in the Great War for Empire, in the 1790s, Pittsburgh faced westward at the great struggle for a continent. We don't often remind ourselves that the United States is the only nation, at least the only one that I know of, that began its independent existence as an empire. That is, as of the peace treaty of 1783, we had, somewhat surprisingly to the peace commissioners, gained land west of the Appalachians that amounted to a greater territory than that governed by the original 13 states. And it was almost entirely unorganized. What Americans did with that empire would quite literally determine the character of their new republic. So this is a good spot to be standing here in Pittsburgh, thinking about whether American independence writ large was a departure from or fulfillment of the British legacy. Well, there, now I've taken 2 pages to get to the first paragraph. Because I want to talk about one of a very special gang of people here, a gang that I call our lost founders. Arthur St. Clair. Arthur St. Clair was president of the Congress of the United States when it passed what was titled An Ordinance for the Government of the Territory of the United States Northwest of the River Ohio on July 13, 1787. Now, note that this was the Articles of Confederation Congress, you know, that weak government under which nothing could possibly get done. After the ratification of the Constitution in 1789, the first Congress elevated the Northwest Ordinance to the status of the organic law of the United States, along with the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution itself. Now, by the time the Congress took this action in the fall of 1789, St. Clair was out in the Northwest Territory, having left Congress to take the job as the first governor of that vast land. He would, in fact, serve as the only governor of the entire territory, the whole territory. He would be fired by Secretary of State James Madison in 1802 for, among other things, opposing Ohio's illegal application for statehood. St. Clair was thus a rare thing in the era of American independence, a rare guy, a lawgiver, shepherding that law himself through the Congress, and a chief executor of organic law. Well, a little bit about St. Clair. He was Scottish born, and he was also from Western Pennsylvania, which is why it's good to bring him up here. He came to America as a British regular during the Great War for Empire and stayed on after the peace, helped out tremendously by a whopping dowry that came with his wife Phoebe, who was a daughter of Governor James Bowdoin and a daughter of the Boston aristocracy. He moved to the Ligonier Valley on the Pennsylvania frontier, drawn here by cheap, abundant land and the presence of so many of his countrymen in these rugged hills. He was what I like to call a developer pioneer, a developer of Westmoreland and Bedford counties, not far to the east of here. And at one time or another, a magistrate who held several offices in those counties, as well as being its colonel of militia and a defender of Pittsburgh against Virginia aggression. Virginia actually invaded Pittsburgh as late as 1774. It was a lovely little thing. St. Clair went and arrested the agents of Virginia who were trying to reestablish their claim and managed to hold them off long enough for Pennsylvania to reestablish its sovereignty. He joined the Continental Army in 1776 and rose to the rank of Major General. He was with Washington at Princeton, at Valley Forge, at Brandywine, at Yorktown, and after the war at Newburgh. After the war, he returned home to straighten out his finances and ended up helping John Dickinson and other Pennsylvania conservatives get rid of the state's disastrous experiment in democracy. He went off to Congress as a result of this political activity and thence, as we have seen, to the Northwest Territory. Now, when Washington took up the presidency, he and his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, were delighted to find their old comrade in arms resident in Cincinnati. After his first summer in Marietta, St. Clair moved down the Ohio River to the little town whimsically named Losantiville, which he immediately renamed Cincinnati. Of course, after the society of which he had been a founding member, the society formed among the officer corps of the Army at Newburgh. And he would have many chances after this, St. Clair would, to name places after American heroes and after Roman heroes as well. Well, Washington and Knox knew that he was a good nationalist, a prudent man, one given to less attention perhaps to his personal fortunes than was expected of public servants in those days. He was expected to do in the Northwest Territory exactly what he had done in Westmoreland and Bedford counties. He told the citizens of Marietta in 1788, "I hope to find joy in reducing the country from a state of nature to a state of civilization." In the Northwest Ordinance, he had a formidable civilizing tool. As a matter of fact, I'm willing to argue that it may have been the best law passed by any human legislature in all of recorded history. It was clear, true to the history and customs of the citizens it meant to regulate. It said neither too much nor too little, which is an immense aid to administration of the law, of course, was capable of enforcement, and outlined an astonishingly wise connection between organized and unorganized territory that prevented a new republic from immediately becoming an old empire. This last characteristic, wise relation between organized and unorganized territory, we might call the great departure from British legacy. And it's a big one. But if we look at the law itself, we realize that all else was fulfillment. The ordinance, Congress said, gave articles of compact between the original states and the people and states in the said territory and shall forever remain unalterable. It was meant to create temporary government for colonial lands and a process through which territories could become states equal in every respect to the original states of the Union. What an astonishing idea. Equal in every respect to the original states of the Union. It began with a practical guarantee of private property and guaranteeing its orderly transmission. What else could what could inspire confidence more? What rights come first? Well, this, of course, is as old as Magna Carta. But putting it first, I think, was a matter of great congressional prudence. The ordinance then turns to colonial administration, making clear that sovereignty during this transition was in the possession of the Congress of the United States, which in turn had the power to appoint a governor and a secretary to assist him, maybe. They could or didn't have to appoint a secretary, and three judges, all responsible to Congress, but with enormous powers. The governor, for example, was almost a monarch in what I think Aristotle would have instantly recognized as a mixed government. He and the judges had full legislative power, although they had to pass laws that were copies of laws in the original states. That is, they could not make up laws. They had to take them verbatim from laws which were already in existence. So as a practical matter, because St. Clair was from Western Pennsylvania, most of the laws of the early Northwest Territory were Pennsylvania laws. No possibility here for innovation. And he had the power to administer the laws. He was commander of militia. He had a point of power over all civil magistrates. He could divide up the territory into counties and townships and court jurisdictions as he saw fit. He could also name them. He was very much like a colonial governor in the early days of the British colonies, perhaps with more power. And this tended to make some settlers very nervous. But St. Clair was also limited not only by his subservience to Congress, but by the fact that every office he could create, not only every law that he could pass, but every office he could create, every political jurisdiction he could carve out of the countryside, had to be one that came directly out of the colonial or republican experience of the original states. In other words, his innovative powers were practically nil. And that was all right with St. Clair. He was concerned with orderly settlement. Like most nationalists and most developer pioneers, he believed that the United States already offered too many opportunities for freedom. He was more interested in duty. From his point of view, the ordinance was a conserving law. It offered a process whereby carefully developed colonies could become equal states in the Union. But first, it laid the institutional and legal and moral bases for that equality. If we look at Articles 1 through 4 of the Ordinance, it guaranteed what we might call the rights of Americans, almost all of which had been the rights of Englishmen the colonials had demanded before 1776. Representation in government, religious liberty, a wide range of common law rights, and included the remarkable statement, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. St. Clair had the background to put these elements of liberty into place because the states, and before that the colonies, had been doing it for nearly 100 years, and because he had done similar things on the Pennsylvania frontier even before the War for Independence. Article 5, which outlined the formation of new states, was ingenious, although it was never followed strictly in practice, but contained the one stipulation that made all the rest work, all the rest of the law, in fact. Congress retained the authority to admit new states once they had submitted a constitution, and those constitutions had to be Republican. When all was said and done, the United States guaranteed through this remarkable law that they would clone themselves in the territories. And because Article 6 was added, banning slavery and involuntary servitude, which, by the way, Southerners in the territory would attempt to reverse right up to the time of the Missouri Compromise, because they added Article 6, I would argue that the ordinance was the best and fullest legal statement of American liberty written during the generation of the founders. But in addition to the intentionally conserving nature of the law itself, it was given practical meaning by an equally traditional nationalist, using institutions that reached back deep into the colonial period, and in many cases hundreds of years back into English history. I'll just mention here two brief examples of what I'm talking about: the township and the effect in the territories of English common law. The Land Ordinance of 1785 had provided that the township was to be the basic unit of local government in the territory. The township was, of course, New England's instrument of local government. And fortunately for St. Clair, the northeast quadrant of what became Ohio had already been given to Connecticut, and Yankees in general were bursting at the New England seams to get out west by the early 1790s. And they knew how to run townships. They didn't have to be taught, and St. Clair didn't have to teach them. To Yankee pioneers, there was very little tension between liberty and order because they had already solved it in 160 years of colonial experience. Read one town history in the Northwest Territory, and you've read them all. Laying out of villages, fair and careful distribution of land, building of churches and schools and academies, establishment of town meetings, elaborate plans for the care of the poor, establishment of militias, including required gun ownership, encouragement of crafts and enterprise. It all reads really like a rehash of Timothy Dwight's travels in New England and New York. What strikes one about law on the territory, on the other hand, in addition to this, is how quickly and thoroughly it brought order to this vast landscape. That is, once the Indians were subdued, and that's a whole other part of the story which I'm intentionally, unfortunately, skipping over today. Once the Indians were subdued, how quickly the law brought order to this vast landscape. Stephen Vincent Benet once wrote, "And the Thames and all the rivers of the kings ran into the Mississippi and were drowned." But as one historian put it, it was just about the opposite. The Thames flowed into the muddy waters of the Mississippi and transformed them, engulfed them, anglicized them forever. The common law literally washed over the countryside. Thousands of pioneer lawyers packed up their Blackstones and went west and established orderly courts that gave would-be Judge Roy Beans scarcely a moment for rough and tumble justice. Now, lest we trust the word of an historian who has merely crawled through the sub-basements of countless county courthouses from western New York to Michigan, referring to me. Take a look at the courthouses themselves. From the beginning, they were testaments to the rule of law, to its continuity. In the early days, they were often Greek Revival or Romanesque. They were always elaborate. They were always well-planned. They were full community efforts and symbols of liberty under law. They were what I like to call the temples of the Republic. After being dismissed by the Jefferson administration, Arthur St. Clair returned to the Pittsburgh area and died here in poverty in 1818. He had lost his entire fortune in the service of the Republic, and in those days, book contracts for disgraced officials were not as lucrative. And his historical fortunes have not picked up much in the 188 years since his death. The Northwest Ordinance, however, as we look back on it, may have provided an even truer founding than the nation's itself. If that is in any measure correct, then Arthur St. Clair was justified in having said to the citizens of Marietta in 1788 that he looked forward to his work with a pleasure something like that attendant upon creation. That his work was more modest than the Creator's would not have bothered him, for he knew what a powerful mixture of creed and culture he had had to work with. Thank you.